Can you describe the media landscape and the type of access which the people in North Korea have to information in general?
Well, in North Korea, they have access to all the forms of communication that we are familiar with, radio, television, but they have access to only very constrained forms of it. So, for instance, in Pyongyang, the central city, the capital city, there are three television stations which broadcast mostly in the evening. In most of the country, you get access to only one or two stations. And there are a number of official radio stations which you can listen to, usually, again, only in the evening. This is the time when there's more electricity. And then there is the main form of communication in North Korea is every home and workplace has a radio hardwired to a central station, and that radio has a volume switch but not an on-off switch, and that particular radio will broadcast music, propaganda, news, all sorts of things, and it's sort of one of the main ways in which the government stays in touch with the people. There are also a number of newspapers that cater to the population in North Korea.
For us in the Western world, it sounds really a bit strange. How did you get access to all the information for your article? Have you been in North Korea, or have you had the chance to talk to regular journalists from North Korea?
Well, I've not been in North Korea. Getting access to North Korea is very difficult, and I've tried, and I almost got in. When the North Koreans found out I was working on the subject, they withdrew my visa. But I've interviewed dozens of people from North Korea, defectors from North Korea, whether they are in South Korea or in Japan. And then I spent a number of weeks in Seoul, South Korea, interviewing members of these journalistic organizations that report on North Korea, and they had very detailed descriptions of what the media conditions are like inside North Korea. So all the information I've received is secondhand, but from people who have actually, physically seen and used the various forms of media that I describe in my article.
You wrote in your article, except for a tiny elite, the people in North Korea are not connected to the internet, to the World Wide Web. What elite is this? Who actually has access to the internet, and what does the North Korean internet look like from inside the country?
Well, the North Koreans have, up until quite recently, had virtually no presence on the internet. The suffix KP, which is for the country North Korea, had been registered to them, but was not used at all up until as recently as this past fall. So for the most part, people inside North Korea use what's called the Kwangmung, which is a intranet, a closed system that can only be used from inside the country and is accessed through various cyber cafes and libraries and post offices and things like that. And it's mostly for accessing information about the country, about the culture. There are some video game kind of games to play on it, and there was at least one time, I'm not sure if it still is, but there was at one time a sort of rudimentary email system. In terms of internet access to the World Wide Web, very few people in the country have access to it at all, and those who do are very aware that their access is being monitored. So the searches they would perform would be very specific and very uncontroversial and I would assume non-ideological, because there's total surveillance of every keystroke there, just as if you are using a cell phone in North Korea, you must also assume that you are being surveilled. It's sort of the total surveillance state in that way.
So when the most people don't have access to something like Facebook or YouTube, how are they using this type of internet? What are they doing there?
The internet or the intranet?
This type of intranet they have.
Well, they go there and they play games on it, and they can look up information. I mean, the way that we might consult databases about the census of the United States, or you know, information you might have if you were doing research papers about your country or something like that. All officially sanctioned and government-produced information. That's really all they have access to. It's really, I think, so that, I mean, North Koreans are very, very, it's interesting this way. They're, you know, Koreans in general are extremely sophisticated when it comes to electronics. South Korea has some of the most sophisticated advanced electronics in the world. They have some of the fastest internet connections anywhere. And North Koreans are very interested in technology as well, so they've tried to sort of, the state has tried to reach a compromise whereby it believes very strongly, and Kim Jong-il has made a number of pronouncements over the years that everyone must learn to use the computer. That's what modern people do. So they've been very conscious of training people in computers, but of course they don't want people to use the computer to do what we would do with the computer, which is find all the information we could. So by putting computers, you know, the actual physical computers in universities, in libraries, in post offices, even in people's homes, but restricting the access, it's sort of like, I mean, think about the way that we used computers before the advent of the Internet. You know, we had, CD-ROMs and video games and, you know, all sorts of things. But that's really very much at the stage that the North Koreans are at in their use of the Internet.
It is obviously that the North Korean society is a closed society, and in your article you wrote that there's no press freedom, obviously, as well. And in your article you mentioned citizen journalists practicing real journalism inside the country. What do they do, and how do they do this?
Well, it's quite a fascinating development, and it's a very recent development that you have people inside North Korea who are practicing something that we would recognize as journalism. They are not obviously officially sanctioned journalists. They are people who have tended to go back and forth over the North Korean-Chinese border, and in China they've met a number of Japanese and South Korean and Chinese as well, journalists who are very interested in getting information about North Korea. And for the most part, what these journalists have done over the years is interview defectors, interview people who are either escaping from North Korea, or interview people who are traders, tradesmen who are leaving North Korea to trade and buy goods that they will then bring back to the country and then sell at a profit. And that's the sort of standard way that information about North Korea has been developed over the years. And then quite recently, I mean, within the last 5 or 6 years, a group of these people who go back and forth over the border started saying, well, look, wait, I will collect information, not just sort of, you know, informal rumors, but I will actually do interviews, I will record interviews, I will take photographs, I will record video, and will act as a journalist, bringing information out to be broadcast on South Korean and Japanese and other media forms.
How do this citizen journalists how do they get the information out of the country? You describe it as a kind of smuggle. How does this smuggle concretely work?
It's very risky. Obviously, these people are literally taking their lives into their hands. If caught bringing information out, or telegraphing, or, you know, phoning, or any, you know, trying to get information about the country out, you are automatically branded a spy. And officially, the punishment for spying is anything, including execution. So the ways they do it, it's really, again, has a lot to do with advances, fairly recent advances with digital technologies. They are bringing information out on thumb drives, on little SD chips. Say if they're recording interviews or taking photographs, they're on digital devices. They're transferred onto SD chips, and they'll bring those out or smuggle them out. They are using telephones and phoning out within about 10 miles of the Chinese North Korean border. You can use telephones that will use the Chinese cell phone system. And they are often, calling into China or using the system to call even into South Korea. And some of the phones are so sophisticated that they are capable of conveying images, even short videos, tape recordings, you know, audio recordings, things like that. And then also, they simply will hand things to people as well. So there are people who will, you know, go across the border from North Korea to China with a SD chip or with a camera or something and give it to people in China who will then smuggle it out of the country there.
And what type of information do they bring out?
Really all sorts of information. I mean, the most dramatic and probably the most the information that's had the greatest impact have been videos that people have taken secretly inside North Korea. A number of these video journalists will put tiny cameras and either hide them on their clothing or in some cases put them in a bag or a briefcase and cut a small hole in the bag or briefcase and then go around and take video of the markets. And these people will actually, I mean, it's quite amazing, they will actually go up to people in the streets, people in the markets, and essentially interview them. And you can see some of these things if you look on the internet, on the web. You can find some of these things, these videos where, you know, for instance, if a video journalist finds this one case, a young girl really who's sort of starving, and her parents have died, and he starts to ask her, "Where are you from? What happened to your parents? How do you survive? What are you eating?" Things like that, and is really conducting the kind of interview that I think any journalist would conduct. At the other end of the spectrum, there is still photography. There's some really wonderful photography, actually quite beautiful color mm-hmm. photography that comes out. They also will Xerox or take photographs of documents and smuggle documents out. When I was in South Korea, I saw North Korean versions of the instruction booklets for using Windows, Microsoft Windows, Microsoft Word, all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. that have been, you know, stolen and then printed in North Korea. So mm-hmm. really it's documents of all sorts.
Years ago, spies and intelligence services used this conspirative strategies, and they used analog technologies like microfilm. Today we have SD cards, we have USB sticks. What has changed?
Well, I think the transportability of this these things have changed. I mean, you can broadcast them out, whether by phone or smuggle them out with these small chips. So they're much more easily hidden, I think, much more easily moved around, and also the quality of the recordings and things are of a much higher quality. So I think that technologically, that's what's really changed. It's just that the ease of transporting these things has made it especially useful in extreme situations like this, where you can't be seen taking out a camera. So, you know, it helps if your camera is tiny, or you can't be seen taking out a tape recorder. So it helps if your digital recorder is tiny. So that's what I think has probably changed for the most part.
We have described now the way out of the information, the way out of the country. But does the information get back in the same way?
Well, there's several ways that the information gets back into the country. The primary way and the organizations that I wrote about primarily are broadcast organizations, radio organizations, and they use both shortwave and just regular AM and FM radio to broadcast back into North Korea. They have various broadcast operations on the Chinese border, in South Korea itself, and other places, and they have a whole, you know, shows of news and drama and all sorts of other things. So broadcast radio is primarily the most efficient way to get information about North Korea back into North Korea. There have also been uses. One man I interviewed had his organization had prepared a number of these thumb drives, which contained all sorts of information, e-books, video and sort of slideshow demonstration of what the world and what life was like outside North Korea, what life was really like in South Korea. I also interviewed people who had put together these compressed CDs, sort of like DVD technology, that had been smuggled back in for people to watch on their computers. So it really runs the gamut of different forms of media that have been used to bring information back into North Korea.
Many people give the internet a lot of credit for revolutions in Tunisia or Egypt. At the same time, critics say the internet is a very effective surveillance tool that can be used to work against protesters. What would you say that a subversive offline network like this network from citizen journalists in North Korea can be more efficient to disrupt a regime?
I think there's certainly a possibility. I mean, the level of censorship, the level of surveillance in North Korea is really unlike anything that I think the world has ever seen. And so you think about someplace like Tunisia or Egypt, for all of the political oppression that was going on there, people did have fairly good access, whether through satellite dishes or through the internet, to information outside. These things almost don't exist or exist in such a limited way as if they don't exist. So I think that the destabilizing potential of these radio broadcasts and CDs and DVDs and thumb drives is fairly minimal. It's not as if I think the people in North Korea are going to rise up and rebel against Kim Jong-il based on what they've been seeing or reading. But I do think that the significance of this is that this development is that 5 or 10 years ago, the number of people who would have had not only the ability but sort of the courage to actually listen to outside sources, to look for outside information, was extremely small. And the numbers of people who have been listening to these broadcasts and enjoying or at least hearing the media and the information from the outside has grown extraordinarily. And with that growth has come a kind of suspicion and skepticism about the things they've been told by the North Korean regime. And that's the significance. It's just that there's a tiny bit of perhaps proto-resistance or early resistance and skepticism, because there's a very high correlation between the willingness to consume outside media and skepticism about the regime. That's one thing that a lot of polls that have been done, studies that have been done among defectors from North Korea have shown, that there is this kind of skepticism that comes from simply listening to the information, almost regardless of what the information is from the outside.
The discouraged people are probably the minority, but is there an effect on the major part of the public?
On the major part of the public?
Yeah. Is there a reaction? Is there an effect?
I think in the sense that the more, even if you yourself, North Korean, are not consuming media from the outside, I think the fact that everyone knows someone who is, I think that at this point, even if you yourself are not listening to the radio or the shortwave radio late at night to these things, you know that there are people who do. It's become more commonplace. Certainly not safe, but more commonplace. And I think with that development has come a sort of very small political space. I mean, if there is no dissent at all in a society, even the tiniest bit of dissent will have a large impact.
Both sides, North Korea on the one hand and South Korea on the other hand, have a very strict agenda when it comes to information control and propaganda. Is there a way to confirm certain news that find their way out of North Korea? Because critical reports about North Korea well might be propaganda from the South.
Absolutely, and that's something that I was very careful about. There is plenty of propaganda created by the South about the North. I don't know if it's as much, but certainly there is propaganda from both sides. This is you have to remember that North and South Korea are technically still at war. People are killed practically on a monthly basis. There are skirmishes, some we hear about, some we don't. There are bombings. So this is a very active war on the peninsula, despite the fact that it seems as if it's sort of a truce or a stalemate. So there is an active propaganda effort going on both ways, which makes it all the more important for a journalist like myself to try to figure out what bits of information are true, which ones are false. What I tried to do in my own research was I tried to take some of the least controversial information that was being reported, things like the evidence of food or lack of evidence of food in markets in certain cities, or the price of rice in certain cities, or weather, the effects of weather. There have been terrible rain storms in North Korea and floods in certain areas and landslides and things like that. Things that are probably a bit easier to confirm. And then I would look for evidence or news and reports of those things in other media to try to figure out which ones were accurate and which ones weren't. I tend to be quite skeptical about any reports having to do with, say, Kim Jong-il or the goings-on of the royal family or the succession plans of the Kim, things like that. Things that are sort of the kind of things that everyone wants to know, but are in reality the kinds of things that almost nobody knows. Information about nuclear weapons, things like that. Those things I take with a grain of salt because those things tend to be rumors upon rumors. It's the other sorts of things which I look at as being more verifiable information. And I was very impressed by how much of the information I gathered from these news organizations that did check out, that was verified.
Last two questions. First question, is the North Korean public informed about the nuclear crisis in Japan?
You know, they are. Through the official media, they are. The KCNA, which is the official news organization, and the Rodong Shinbun, which is the official newspaper, have both run several articles about the nuclear disaster in Japan. They ran an article last week about the fact that South Korea had sent experts to help with the damage there, and they talked about the dangers of nuclear air and you know, mm-hmm. radiation drifting up to North Korea, which is probably not a great chance. But they, I think it was an opportunity that they saw to point the finger at someone else for being irresponsible with nuclear weapons. I think they saw this as a great opportunity for the North Koreans to shake their finger at another power for being, you know, irresponsible or allegedly irresponsible with nuclear issues. So, yes, so they have reported on that. They have not reported on anything going on in the Middle East or Egypt or Tunisia. No. I have been scouring the North Korea official media ever since the various rebellions started, and there's not been one word about that. And in fact, there's been quite a crackdown on media organizations. There have been a lot more policing on the borders, and people looking for reporters using their telephones to get information in and out of North Korea. The North Korean regime is very worried that people will start hearing about these kinds of uprisings.
Last question. We live in a globalized world, in a digital connected world, on the one hand. On the other hand, North Korea seems to be the archetype of a closed society. From your point of view, how much longer can such an isolated regime exist?
You know, I people have been predicting the demise of North Korea for 50 years, 60 years now, and it has been remarkably resilient in much the way that people in my country have been predicting the demise of Cuba for many years, and that does not seem to be any closer to collapsing. So with that said, I think that the pace of change has gotten so much faster in North Korea. The exchange of information has gotten so much faster. The example I like to use is in the mid to late 90s, when there were these terrible famines in North Korea, the news of these famines took many months and even years to get out. There were isolated reports of starvation in this town or that town, but they couldn't be confirmed. People were very skeptical about them because they thought they were propaganda created by anti-North Koreans in the South, and it wasn't really until the late 90s and early 2000s that the famine was confirmed and aid started flowing into North Korea way too late. Now, compare that to 2009, 2010, where in 2010, the fall of 2010, the North Koreans devalued their currency, the won, to get rid of the hoarding that was going on. And it was announced on a Monday morning that there was going to be a new currency, which was going to be 1/100th of the current currency. So if you had 100 won, the new currency would give you 1 won in the new currency, which of course wiped out all sorts of wealth that had been collecting there. The information was announced on the Monday morning. By Monday afternoon, it was being broadcast on these radio stations that I've been describing, independent radio stations. By Tuesday morning, you could get on the internet and see a photograph of one of the new North Korean notes. That kind of information, the speed with which that information got out, was just breathtaking, and is so different from anything that took place 5 and 10 years before that. And I think what the implications of that will be remains to be seen, but that kind of information coming out so quickly, I think, can't help but be destabilizing on any regime whose very legitimacy depends on controlling these streams of information both in and out.
Mr. Boynton, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you very much for talking. I appreciate it.